Welcome back. Today, we're really digging into something vital, climate justice and, well, inequities. Our mission here is to sort of unpack how the fight against what's called environmental racism, often very localized here in the U.S., actually paved the way for this bigger global call for climate justice. We're talking about how the climate crisis, as it gets worse, doesn't hit everyone equally. Its burdens fall along these old lines of inequality. So where do we start with this?
Yeah, and what's really fascinating, I think, is how we'll see these surprising connections unfold. You know, past injustices, they don't just echo, they actually light up the challenges we're facing globally right now. There are some really crucial lessons there.
That's a really important distinction, because often people hear environmentalism and they think, you know, saving forests or whales, wilderness preservation. But this story, the start of environmental injustice in the U.S., it's different, isn't it? It begins as a civil rights issue. How did that movement actually kick off?
Oh, absolutely. A core civil rights issue. The term environmental racism itself. That was Reverend Dr. Benjamin Chavis Jr. back in 1982. It came out of these intense protests in Warren County, North Carolina. They were fighting putting a toxic waste landfill right in a mostly black community. That event gave a name to it all.
Okay, so that named the problem. But what about making it stick?
Yeah.
Showing it wasn't just one place getting the data out there.
Right. That's where Dr. Robert Bullard comes in. People often call him the father of environmental justice. His work was key. It really started with his 1979 study in Houston, groundbreaking stuff. It provided the hard evidence showing waste facilities were overwhelmingly sited in black neighborhoods. It proved what activists knew. These weren't isolated incidents. It was systemic.
And you can still see that legacy playing out so clearly today. I mean, look at Cancer Alley in Louisiana. It's not just a name. It's an 85-mile stretch packed with, what, over 150 industrial sites? The cancer risk near some plants, like Denka DuPont, they say it's maybe 50 times the national average. That's staggering. And its roots are deep in historical segregation. Activists like Sharon Levine are still fighting this.
Exactly. And this is where we see how these local fights scale up. Climate change becomes this threat multiplier. It grabs those existing vulnerabilities we see in places like Cancer Alley and just blows them up onto a global stage. That's why climate justice has these, well, four key parts. Distributive, meaning fair sharing of burdens and benefits, unlike Cancer Alley. Procedural, so affected people get a say, like those Warren County activists wanted. Recognition, valuing the knowledge of vulnerable groups, like indigenous communities. And critically important, intergenerational justice, thinking about how what we do now impacts the future. That's the youth cry, isn't it?
Right. So take those local injustices like Cancer Alley.
Yeah.
How do they look on that global scale? What's this global north-south chasm about and this idea of climate debt?
It's a huge imbalance. Basically, industrialized nations, mostly the global north, cause most of the historical emissions. So they owe this climate debt to the global south, estimates. Maybe U.S. $192 trillion by 2050 for adaptation, for the emissions debt itself. And what often happens is that climate finance comes as loans. So it just adds to the debt burden for countries already struggling. It's not really reparations.
The human impact is just devastating when you look at specific examples.
It really is. Think about Ile de Jean Charles in Louisiana, the Biloxi Chittimacha Choctaw tribe. They're basically America's first climate refugees. They've lost, what is it, 98% of their land since 1955 to rising seas. It's not just land, it's culture, it's identity being washed away, forcing relocation. Or Hurricane Katrina, how it hit black communities harder because of segregation and then flawed recovery efforts afterwards, like needing formal property deeds, which many didn't have. These are stark examples.
Yeah. And yet some of the smallest nations, small island developing states, SADs, they become huge forces. They contribute like less than 1% of global emissions, but face truly existential threats. Tuvalu, Kiribati, but they've had real successes, haven't they? Pushing for that 1.5 degree target in the Paris Agreement, getting the loss and damage fund agreed at COP 27. It's quite remarkable. And these fights continue right now. Look at Standing Rock, the hashtag NoDPL resistance in 2016-2017. That was about so much more than a pipeline. It was indigenous sovereignty, treaty rights, clean water. Ni Wakoni water is life. That echoed everywhere.
Definitely. And you see that same fierce demand for justice from the youth, right? The Fridays for Future movement Greta Thunberg kicked off. That really embodies intergenerational justice. Her saying, "You are failing us." It's such a powerful accusation, demanding accountability for the future they'll inherit.
So pulling this together, what does it mean going forward? We hear about a just transition. What's that really about? It means making sure that as we shift away from fossil fuels, which we have to do, we support the workers and communities affected by that shift. it's absolutely critical we don't just create new sacrifice zones, even in the green economy. It has to be equitable.
Exactly. At the end of the day, you can't have effective climate solutions without tackling these root injustices. The completely intertwined, solve one, you have to solve the other.
So something for you, the listener, to really think about. What does it genuinely mean to shift from a system built on extraction and sacrifice to one based on regeneration and solidarity? How do we ensure that no community and no generation is ever considered expendable again? That's your thought for today.